Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inch. Glad to have you with us. And we're also pleased to welcome back to the program Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a practice in her area. She also teaches at U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. And once a month, she is on this program and talks about women's health. She usually comes prepared to talk about a few things that might be new or information she thinks you might find useful, so we can do that. But also, she is here as a resource for people who are listening. Now, if you have questions, you know, the kinds of things that you could think about talking about with an OBGYN, you're certainly welcome to call. Now, the one caveat I always add when we have a physician on the program, I just like to people to remember that we can't diagnose over the telephone. So there are limits on what we can do because the doctor, this doctor or any of the doctors that we have, and we have a lot of them, they can't see you. So keep that in mind. And if you have real concerns about your health, you certainly should go and pursue that with your own doctor. But we do these shows to help you add to your store of healthcare knowledge, and it might be a good place to start or to get some basic kinds of information. So that's what it's all about here, and we will be happy to take as many people as would like to call and like to talk with the doctor. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois or Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel. Even if you have me listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you could use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Well, it's good to have you here once again.
Good morning.
We usually start out by talking about
Some new things.
So what's on your list?
Well, in the state of Illinois, we have a new law that probably hasn't been enacted in all parts of our state. But after the birth of a baby, by law, there is a bank that is saving cord blood. And you can go through the consent process and either decline to have your baby's cord blood banked or offer it to the state to have that cord blood banked for general use, or if you should change your mind and want that cord blood banked for your baby's own use, I think the cost is about $1,000 for that. So I think what everybody's hoping is that enough individuals will generally bank some of their baby's cord blood for widespread use, and the use is are probably just now being discovered, but could be from lots of things. Of course, transfusions of very early newborns is one potential use right off the bat, but more sophisticated uses in the way that we're talking about using stem cells is obviously another very important use of this cord blood.
So here we're talking about the blood that's in the umbilical cord?
Essentially, it's some of the blood's in the umbilical cord. Some of the blood is in the placenta. The way the collection devices are designed, we usually can obtain about a unit of blood.
So how much is that?
250 cc, so, 8 ounces, something like that.
Okay.
I'm always ounce conversion.
That doesn't seem to me to be a lot.
Oh, well, that's a good amount.
It is, okay.
Yeah. So, there are cases where perhaps the baby's born too early, or there isn't a lot of blood in the placenta, or there are emergency considerations that have to take priority so that they don't obtain the blood in enough time before it's clotted. But probably in hospitals across the state, people are going to be offered to be able to do this. And it's a fairly lengthy consent. I think the form is about 10 pages long. Haven't read it all myself yet, but they try to explain very well what's going to happen with this blood and who would have access to the blood and how the whole program works.
Mm, okay. Well, I can understand if the baby would need blood. And obviously, anytime someone needs blood, it's best if they got their own blood. So that's, for example, if people are going to have surgery and they think they're going to need blood, one of the things they can do in advance is to give blood. They can bank that, and then so if they need it, you get your own back. So if baby needs blood, the first thing you'd want to do is use that. But is that blood somehow different from blood you would draw from an adult?
Oh yes, fetal red blood cells are are very different than adult red blood cells. And also their white cells are a little bit different, and they're all a little bit more plastic. They can be cultured differently, and they can be used in ways that are less likely to be rejected from other individuals. So there are a number of benefits to banking cord blood.
Okay.
That are different than adult blood.
Okay. So you would say people offer that opportunity, you would say, no, you think that's a good idea.
I think it's an excellent idea. And I know for my obstetrics patients, we have some of the forms in the office so that people can get a chance to read them and see what this whole program's going to be about. And I encourage people to look into it. There, for a long time now, there have been private banks where you could pay and store your baby's blood privately so that if that baby ever needed, a cancer therapy and then needed, say, bone marrow therapy, those kinds of things would be available. So this is now done on a statewide basis. And I don't off the top of my head know if other states are starting to offer this service, but I suspect they would be.
Okay. We have a caller here ready to go. I want to tell people who are listening that our guest this morning is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's here on the program every month. Always on a Monday in the 10 o'clock hour, and we do these shows to give you the chance to ask questions about women's health. So the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And the caller is on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about cervical cancer, and is that a faster, slow-growing cancer? And secondly, when you get back an abnormal pap smear, it's at the most mild level, so it's the mild abnormal dysplasia, mild dysplasia, or whatever. My understanding is that there are at least a couple of options. One is to just wait and do another pap in a few months and see how it comes out, or do the cryosurgery, which freezes the cells on the cervix. Could you explain what the advantages and disadvantages of both of those are?
Okay, well, first, in terms of cervical cancer, most cervical cancers in the world today are caused by a malignant transformation of cervical cells by the human papillomavirus. And that's a fancy way of saying that there are certain types of the wart virus, known as the HPV virus, that are more likely to cause actual fundamental changes in the way a cell of the cervix behaves and cause it to become a tumorous growth. Now, unfortunately, the flip side of that is that there are a tremendous number of HPV viruses, something like 70. Many will never cause a cancer. Even those that can cause a cancer most often will be a self-limited infection of a patient's cervix. But in the United States, we don't see very many cervical cancers in women who have regular pap smears because we typically will pick up these early precancerous changes in women who are either their teenage years or their young 20s, and we get these things treated. And how to treat them, I'll get back to that in a second because that was part of your question. But we get these conditions effectively treated, and therefore the chance that any of these cases are ever going to go on to become an invasive cervical cancer is very remote. Now, in the United States today, we see a number of cervical cancers. The average age that women present with cervical cancer is usually somewhere between 30 and 50. So if we assume that most people start their intercourse in their late teens, early 20s, it probably is a process of 20 or 30 years for everything to develop. And why some women who pick up the right type of virus don't become cancerous and why some women do then succumb to cervical cancer, we don't completely understand, but we know that there are things called cofactors. So your individual genetic heritage, whether or not you smoke, these things are known cofactors in getting cervical cancer. Because we have such an epidemic of people infected with the human papillomavirus, We have been able to study this very, very extensively, and it would take me more than a week of programs to explain all of this in full. So I always have to put the caveat when I'm talking about this subject that it's very important for individuals who have abnormalities of their own to sit down with their own healthcare provider and get some of this information on their own. But what's most important to realize is that about 7 out of 10 of these cases do resolve on their own. But secondly, what's most important is that you carefully get a diagnosis. And a diagnosis means that the pap smear is a screening test and the actual diagnosis is made based on colposcopy. And then based on the colposcopy result, you find out what your options are. In the early most stages, yes, a short period of observation, it can be very helpful. Beyond that, treating the cervix is important. And you can be treated in the early stages with either freezing, laser, or an actual surgery, and it's up to the individual physician and the individual case to pick what type of procedure to have. So hopefully that helps.
Okay. And if you have one of those, like cryosurgery or laser surgery or whatever, that just basically kills those cells, and then you're free and clear of all that?
Well, there are two things. One is a treatment of the actual area that the cells have changed, and the second thing is clearing the virus. You're more likely to clear the virus if you've had a surgical treatment, but that doesn't mean you're going to clear the virus. And for people who haven't cleared the virus, they're truly not cured. They can have recurrences or any of the factors that led that virus to produce that effect to begin with can occur again.
Okay, so then you have to follow up with pap smears.
Yes.
Okay, and so waiting, you said 7 out of 10 resolve by themselves. Is there any
right, but it's but first of all, it's important that in addition to the pap smear, you know if you're infected with the viruses so you can have tests whether you have incurred a low-risk or high-risk virus, and whether understanding whether waiting is correct in a case like yours or a different woman is a very individual decision between your physician and you, and what you need to find out are what are the risks and benefits of waiting, what are the risks and benefits of proceeding. And a lot may determine what else is going on, what type of contraception, how at risk are you for picking up the virus again, what other sexually transmitted infections have you ever had. There are many factors that would lead your physician to decide that in your case it's good to wait or in your case it may not be good to wait.
Okay, last question. Are there any disadvantages of having the cryosurgery? I mean, are there any complications? Would there ever be a good reason to just not go ahead and do that?
Well, there are risks and benefits to every surgery, infection, bleeding, complications relating to the amount of tissue removed are all a factor. And there are other procedures like the LEAP procedure that we feel have lower rates of those kinds of complications in most cases. But cryosurgery still can be effective, and it's the least expensive of the surgical alternatives, so it is something that is safely used by many women.
Okay, and what was that? What did you just mention that you think is a safer approach? Did you say LEAP?
Mm-hmm, it's a loop electrosurgical excision procedure.
Oh.
So we wish you luck in individually speaking to your own physician.
Okay, thank you.
Right, very good. We'll go on next to another caller, and this caller is in Effingham, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I just got finished taking a lady to the WIC office. I speak some Spanish and help some of the Mexican families here in town, and it's really getting to be serious. Obstetricians are hard to come by. What I'm afraid is going to happen is that we're going to have to get do-it-yourself kits, and these ladies are just going to go in there at 0 hour without any prenatal care. I did talk to the WIC worker to see if there was some kind of something that they could do for them on a monthly basis when they come in there, like take their blood pressure. And it's just a real, and I know, you know, that there are doctors that have taken our people, but they're just getting overextended, and they're just not that many to be found. Can you come up with any ideas?
You're bringing up a great point, and probably if you and I were sitting down to tea, we could get right to the heart of the matter. Probably a lot of our listeners don't even know what you're talking about.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So let me step back a tiny bit and see if I can summarize and kind of hit some of the important issues on the phone. And I usually, these kinds of topics get so political and economic, and I tend to have usually tended to avoid them on the radio. But many people may know that WIC stands for Women, Infants, and Children, and it is a state-sponsored program that is a sort of a follow-along nutrition program to provide moms and then their newborn babies with additional nutritional information, nutritional assessments, and sometimes food and other assistance. It is not a prenatal care program. Many people who, pretty much anybody could go and be served by the WIC office, but it is primarily for lower income women. And many of these lower income women either have no health insurance that covers prenatal care, or modest health insurance, or state-sponsored health insurance, such as public aid. And in many communities, the access by public aid patients to physicians who will do their obstetrical care has started to be limited. And the reasons are vast for this. In our community of Champaign-Urbana, and I know you're calling from Effingham, so I have a little bit of knowledge of what goes on in Effingham, but I don't pretend to know exactly what's going on there. But in Champaign-Urbana, basically, if you call any board-certified obstetrician gynecologist's office, what you will be told at Carl's is that they aren't accepting new public aid patients. What you will be told at Christie is they are not be accepting new public aid patients. There's one other independent physician in town who will tell you the same thing. And if you call my office, I say that I accept new patients on referral from another physician. So I have a little bit more access right at the moment. We have Francis Nelson Health Center, and we have Champaign Planned Parenthood, both of whom do accept patients. I don't know whether they have limitations or not. I know they have some limitations in the type of patients they can care for and accept. But in short, access to prenatal care to public aid patients has been somewhat limited. And it's piggybacked on the fact that we have an accelerating malpractice crisis in our state, whereas individuals like myself used to pay $35,000 a year in malpractice. Mine is up to $70,000. I've been told that's good. I know of physicians in other states and in the Chicago area that get charged $250,000 a year for malpractice. And perhaps depending on what type of care you give, you may in fact get reimbursed, say, $1,000 for a public aid delivery. And so if you actually figure out what that means, you have to do a tremendous amount of work just to cover your malpractice costs. And what's happened is that physicians have either stopped doing obstetrics or been forced out because they can't afford affordable malpractice. They can't, the bottom has met the top and you can't make money. So they figure, well, if I can't make money, I guess I won't work. And it's just accelerating to a crisis because of last year there was approximately $1.74 paid out in malpractice awards for each dollar taken in by insurance companies, so that physicians are feeling very squeezed, and just holding down our premiums is not going to be the answer, because it's a big complicated problem of not every outcome is good, not every outcome could have been prevented. Some outcomes could be prevented. Some lawsuits are frivolous. Many are not. It's a very complicated situation. And it needs to have a lot of solutions. We feel like in the state of California, for instance, they have caps and they have other things called tort reform that has helped. And I am not political. I can't even explain tort reform to any great extent. But I do know that it's driving in our area women to find it difficult to find physicians to see them prospectively with prenatal care, which we know improves the health of both mom and baby.
Yeah, but I hear what you're saying, but there must be, the medical profession must be looking at some possible alternatives, or else they just say, well, when you're in labor, go to the emergency room and somebody will take care of you. Is that the answer?
There are many organizations. I know Dr. Elizabeth Cannell is doing a grassroots organization regarding what she thinks are the solutions. If you go to the AMA website, they have potential solutions. If you go to the American College of OBGYN website, they have solutions. If you go to Illinois State Medical Society Insurance Exchange, they have political action items. If you go to even Planned Parenthood's their political action section, they have potential solutions. So I think there are a lot of potential solutions. I do think expanding midwifery care is going to help.
Oh, tell me about that. That sounds good.
Well, Carl has midwifery services, and I don't know what their current policies are or what their future policies are going to be. I know at Provena Covenant we haven't had midwives, but I'm hoping to have midwives in my practice by the end of the summer. And so I'm hoping with that we will have some flexibility around here. Now, I doubt if very many Effingham patients are going to come here to deliver in Champaign-Urbana.
Yeah,
but these may be the kinds of solutions that the local hospitals can adapt as well. And but definitely, I think it is tied in with these problems of both malpractice and reimbursement. I tend to say if Wonder Bread gets, I don't mean to do a brand, if the bread people get charged more for flour, they can mark the bread up. But most of us are on fixed reimbursement, so it doesn't matter. It doesn't. We can't mark the item up. We get paid the same amount, so it's a matter of maybe working more hours in a day to bring in more money to pay this premium. But many of us pretty much work all the hours that we have to work in the day, so it's an expanding problem.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. We have somebody here in Urbana standing by. Let me just reintroduce our guest, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is here each month on this program, always on a Monday, to talk about women's health and to try to answer people's questions. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has practice here in our area. She also teaches U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. And I know if you have a question, she will do her best. Given the constraints of the fact that we're here talking to people over the telephone, she'll do her best to give you an answer. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the cord blood bank sounds like a great idea. I wish that that had been available when I had my baby. I have a question that I'm not sure if it's an obstetric question or a pediatric question, but I'll go ahead and ask it anyway. I was wondering if Dr. Truppen knows if there's any plan for a breast milk bank or if there's anywhere that breastfeeding women can donate extra milk that they might have.
You know, that is a great question, and that was sort of a thing of mine that I was interested in years and years and years ago, and I really have not heard anything about it. I have always heard, and this is something I haven't looked up in a long time, and I should get on the get to the library websites and figure out whether there's any new research. But one of the things that stopped us is that a number of years ago, 20, 25, when people started to think in this sort of direction and they started to test human milk as compared to, say, animal milk, humans have different concentrations of fat in their milk. And I was led to believe that many humans have milk that accumulated so much toxin because of our eating behaviors and the pesticides in foods and so forth and so on. We don't necessarily have as regulated feeds even as some of our animals do. And I was told that this would be an issue, how to try to control the levels of toxins and pesticides and everything like that in human milk. And then the political uproar if your milk couldn't pass mustard. And So many more moms are breastfeeding now. So when they were interested in banked milk, when we had these really extraordinarily low rates of breastfeeding in the population, and we have done great in terms of improving how many new moms start breastfeeding, how many new moms continue breastfeeding up to 6 weeks, and how many new moms continue long-term breastfeeding, whatever you want to label long-term, but past 6 months, past a year. So I think that perhaps some of the need for that has gone down a little bit too. And we have such good breast pumps. Some people have more of a problem with their milk quantity, but then having to substitute in a bottle, babies get a little bit lazy. And some babies go back and forth from bottle to breast easily, but many don't. So I don't know of anything like that, but I'll look into it again. I haven't looked into it in a long time.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. And again, to another Urbana caller, this would be line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. My daughter-in-law has had babies recently, and we were talking about miscarriages occurring in someone else in the family. And she said that her obstetrician said that because of the accessibility of really good pregnancy tests so that you can tell earlier, and because it's easy for people to now do their own pregnancy tests, I may not quite have the details right. This is a long ago conversation. She said women are realizing that they are miscarrying very early, more so than they were before. And I was wondering if that is indeed the case, and whether and what percentage of fertilized eggs don't implant or miscarry very early that people aren't so much aware of it. Or what percentage of fertilized eggs don't make it? Do you have any idea?
What you're saying is absolutely right. Most eggs don't make it. And depending on how early you want to detect it, in fertility institutes where they do these blood tests and they find the second that an egg's been fertilized, they estimate that 80% of eggs don't make it. But what your obstetrician was saying is correct. We've got these great pregnancy tests, and we can find out even a day or two before we miss a period if we're pregnant. And we don't miss that diagnosis very often anymore. And yes, many pregnancies are not doomed to go on, are doomed not to go on, and therefore it probably appears in these current generations that they have more miscarriages than a few generations back prior to these pregnancy tests. But we've had these good ones for a while, so I think our rates will stabilize out.
Well, it was mainly she was talking about the psychological effect on women, because then the pressure begins to build up. And it also seems to me it puts a different perspective on the whole issue of this right to life stuff and so forth. If you have such a high percentage of pregnancies naturally not continuing, it seems to me it gives a different perspective on things. Thanks a bunch.
Okay. Let's see. We'll go on to our next caller, and that's someone in Terre Haute on line four. Toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Am I on the air?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question for the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I have Hashimoto's disease or hypothyroidism, and I've read that some individuals like myself have trouble conceiving a pregnancy. And the information I read is that sometimes people like me will become pregnant, but yet their own autoimmune system doesn't allow the pregnancy to sustain. Is that a real, can that really happen? I kind of dug around on Medline. I couldn't find a lot of information about it, so I wanted to
More in the way of a theory. Okay. I didn't mean to cut you off, sorry.
No, that's fine.
Definitely, if you have untreated thyroid disease, both conceiving and carrying a pregnancy are more difficult. Once your thyroid disease is treated and you're taking supplemental thyroid and your thyroid values are normalized, at that point, it's a little bit more controversial whether any of the antibodies that Hashimoto's thyroiditis produces can either affect the placental implantation or cross the placenta and affect the baby. Most of the information is that it's safe to proceed with a pregnancy, and that miscarriage rates are as I was talking with the last caller, are fairly high anyway, and so the studies aren't really too convincing as to whether you miscarried just because that's such a hot, a common phenomenon, or an untreated condition. The other part for individuals with any autoimmune disease is that they tend to occur in clusters. So if you have an autoimmune disease against one gland, you may in fact have an autoimmune disease against another gland, and it may be these other conditions that would lead to a lot more difficulty. It's a little bit of evidence for premature menopause as well. We call it PIF, premature ovarian failure, POF. Get my mixed metaphors there or something. But at any rate, if your value is stable, it would be safe to proceed. And if you'd like more individual information, we usually suggest consultation with a perinatologist. Those are physicians who specialize in high-risk pregnancies.
Okay, great. You've been very helpful. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call. We'll continue. And our next caller should be in Hoopston on our line number 2 right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question concerning an autoimmune disease. It's giant cell or temporal arteritis. And I was diagnosed in 2001 in May, and I'm still on all of the meds for it, and we can't seem to make any headway. I just wondered what your suggestion would be to get some relief from this.
Well, it is something I learned about a long time ago, and I have heard of it, but it's enough remote from women's health that beyond some of the basics for a complicated case, I don't think I can give you very good advice. Sometimes you may want to consult either an endocrinologist or a hematology oncologist, and those are the kinds of individuals that might offer some additional information. Also, some neurologists treat this kind of condition. So perhaps just getting a second opinion would be a good idea.
Well, I have been to a rheumatologist over the entire time, but the CRP rate remains so high and the sedimentation rate remains so high, and those are things I don't understand. And I'm having night sweats, and mm-hmm. I'm 80 years old and never have had that before.
So. Mm-hmm. Well, we understand a lot about what causes inflammation in the body and high CRP rates and high sedimentation rates, and we understand a little bit about how to treat them, but those values don't always normalize after we treat them. And I know that that is a persistent problem in other areas of medicine as well, like with heart disease.
Well, that's a question. Should I try to get that down? I'm on, prednisone and methotrexate, and nothing seems to get it down. And I'm wondering, I'm just destroying my bones, having broken bones and so forth. So I wonder where to stop medicine.
Well, for some of the complicated cases of osteoporosis, we now have a drug, parathyroid hormone, and you might be a candidate for some treatment like that, but probably your case is individual enough and unusual enough that I'm not going to be able to offer you any better advice either.
An endocrinologist might help me.
Perhaps.
Perhaps.
Okay, thank you.
Well, good luck. We're talking this morning with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She is on this program once a month, always on a Monday. We talk about women's health. And if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have two local callers now waiting, and we'll go to the first one, Champagne, line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question for the doctor.
Yes.
I'm 35 years old, and I'm 3 months into my first pregnancy. And 14 years ago, I had a stroke, and it was most likely related to the birth control pill that I was on. And since then, I've had no other significant health problems at all, and I'm fairly active, and my blood pressure is, being kept within range. But I was just wondering if my doctor, my OBGYN, is trying to get me to consider having a C-section. And I was wondering what your OBGYN thinks about that advice, and I would probably prefer to have a vaginal delivery if it were at all possible. And I just wanted to hear what your doctor had to say about that.
Well, when lay people use the word stroke, there's usually two types of stroke. One's hemorrhagic, one's thrombotic. Most likely, if you had a stroke at the time that you were on birth control pills, it was due to thrombosis. And it's extraordinarily rare for anyone to have a stroke while they're on birth control pills. And it's most commonly found in somebody who has a disorder called thrombophilia. So that if you weren't pregnant, usually the recommendation would be to do a set of blood tests looking for causes of these conditions. And in our population, the Leiden factor, it's an abnormality of one of the blood clotting factors, factor 5, is probably responsible for most of the thrombophilias that we see. We could probably pick them up in about one in every 600 women that we would test, but because the test is so expensive, we just don't do it unless there's other conditions. Right when you're early pregnant, testing for some of these thrombophilias becomes difficult because pregnancy itself throws off some of these numbers and interpretation becomes a little bit more difficult. So it's something where perhaps a hematologist could help decide whether you'd need this evaluation. In people who have had these conditions and are pregnant, they're potentially candidates for doing other kinds of strategies to lower their risk of throwing a blood clot in over these 9 months when your clotting factors are naturally rising due to the high production of estrogen by your placenta. And usually if we have a patient who has factors like that, it's a good idea to talk with a perinatologist. And in our community, we have one at Carle, one at Covenant, and they can give you consultation not only about the delivery process itself, but the process of taking care of you during this pregnancy and evaluating you for any clots should they arise.
Okay. My OBGYN is in consult with a perinatologist. And since it's very early in the pregnancy, I've just had the first round of blood tests and all of that. So I'm expecting she'll give me more advice as the pregnancy progresses. So. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. Let's continue. Our next caller is also in Champaign, and this is line number one.
Hi. I have a question about birth control. I'm 23 years old, and I recently was diagnosed with interstitial cystitis, and I was wondering if there's any good options for birth control for somebody with this disorder, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Well, we've known about interstitial cystitis for a long time, but we haven't had a lot of good treatments for it and not a lot of good tests to confirm that it exists. Most people may or may not know that interstitial cystitis is basically a condition where the bladder wall itself is inflamed, so there's no active infection, but essentially the woman who has this condition feels lower abdominal pain or burning with urination or discomfort at the time of intercourse, and that it can be almost so severe that it's a disabling condition, or it can be relatively mild so that it's something annoying and nagging that you've literally had for years and never gotten diagnosed. And there's a new medicine, Elmiron, and the recent studies with this medicine have looked at a simplistic questionnaire system, and they found that certain signs and symptoms are very highly correlated with the diagnosis, and it's really simplified diagnosing women, and we're finding many, many more women who thought they had other conditions of pelvic pain, endometriosis, or other kinds of conditions, and in fact, they have interstitial cystitis. So there are many women who have this. There are no really good studies that show that birth control pills would make this worse or better, so that we think that birth control pills are still a good, safe alternative. It's possible that the patch instead of the pill providing more stable blood levels might be a better alternative, but we don't really know. There's really no reason that a person with interstitial cystitis couldn't have the intrauterine device. There's no medical studies that show that it's a problem. There are also, similarly, no medical studies that have really looked extensively at having a tubal ligation. I know our caller's only 23, but still in our population, if you look at women ages 35 and over, many of these women also have interstitial cystitis, and one-third of women age 35 and older contracepts by being sterilized. And now we have these new sterilization procedures by putting the little Escher devices into the corners of the uterus where the tubes enter, and there's no medical evidence that an Escher device couldn't be used by somebody with interstitial cystitis, although Escher is a permanent device. So I think that basically for women with interstitial cystitis, the crux of the matter is to get an accurate diagnosis and try to get adequately treated. But I know of no reason they couldn't use most of the standard birth control. The one area that people have a question about is use of Depo-Provera. Women on Depo-Provera might be a little bit low overall in their total estrogen dose, and that might increase vaginal dryness. So at the time of intercourse, it might exacerbate the symptoms rather than help, but that would be due to a different mechanism, not really due to worsening of the interstitial cystitis.
Okay, well,
hopefully that helps.
And if the caller wanted to follow up, she could call back. We do have about 7 or 8 minutes left in the program with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. So if you have questions about women's health, you can give us a call. We've gotten a lot of calls, and we did talk about right at the beginning about the banking of the cord blood. Are there some other things that you'd like to talk about?
I was going to talk. There's been quite a bit in the medical literature recently about vitamin D, and that was the only other thing I was going to tell our one caller about her temporal arthritis. We're finding so much out about vitamin D. Some people with increased risk for osteoporosis actually have low blood vitamin D levels and can benefit from vitamin D injections, and there's been some research that vitamin D actually reduces your chance of getting arthritis. Now, that's not the same condition she was calling in with, but we recommend that most adults get about 600 international units a day of vitamin D, and pretty much in our population have to do it with supplementation either through fortified milk or milk products that are fortified or taking a vitamin pill because we're not out in the sun enough to convert enough vitamin D in our body. So I think that that research is kind of appealing because it's a very easy thing to do and benefits your bones as well as other things.
That's one thing that people need to, I guess, keep in mind. There certainly has been a lot of attention paid to need for particularly for women to have adequate calcium to make sure that they have strong bones. But also you have to make sure that you have vitamin D, and that somehow helps your body.
It helps your body absorb calcium.
Absorb the calcium. So that's why you put it in milk.
Correct. Most of the calcium passes right through either into our stool or into our urine. So we need any little bit we can suck out into the bloodstream on that trip is of benefit. And vitamin D helps that absorption in the GI tract.
Okay. We have someone who I'm sure is an internet listener. They're calling from Maryland, College Park, Maryland, line number one right here. Hello.
Hi. Good morning.
Yeah.
I'm really happy that you're having this show. I have a quick question. I'm going to hang up and listen to the answer. Can you tell me if there's any complications or should a person not take prescribed medication like Glucophage, which I was taking for PCO, or Valtrex when you're trying to get pregnant or in the early stages of pregnancy? And I'm just going to hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Well, we don't know of any harmful effects of glucophage. And in fact, there have been many studies using glucophage to treat gestational diabetics. So where we used to, when patients got with PCO, were taking glucophage when they got pregnant, we would just take them off. But actually, there's some information that says that they'd be better off staying on. So I would think that it's safe to stay on as you try to conceive. Of course, individual consultation with your own healthcare providers, extremely important. Same too with Valtrex. there have been a number of studies. There was a whole new set of guidelines by the CDC regarding sexually transmitted infections, and they stopped short of recommending that pregnant people stay on their Valtrex, but since that, or stay on any of their antivirals to prevent herpes outbreaks while they were either carrying a baby or in the process of birth. But there's a lot of new studies that say that that is probably safe as well. But in these kinds of matters, we do defer to your own health care provider and suggest that you look at the PDR. Unfortunately, the PDR tends to be stricter than what many doctors are, because the physicians know about the most current research, and PDR takes a little bit to catch up with some of that most current research. But neither of them are category D or X, meaning any drug that's category X you must not take while conceiving or it's known to cause birth defects. And category D, you'd really have to have strong indications to stay on that drug and not a different drug while conceiving or pregnant. But both of those drugs are, off the top of my head, I don't remember. I think they're both B.
Okay. Cell phone caller here, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Hi. I was just wondering if she could speak generally about anemia, and then also when you have blood work done, what the normal levels are for women. And I'm just going to hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
Many women just know of anemia as a sort of iron poor blood, and definitely your oxygen carrying capacity is reduced if you're anemic. You can also be deficient in other types of vitamins like the B vitamins, and that can cause different types of anemia. But most young people, it's strictly due to decreased iron levels, either due to the fact that you're not getting enough in your diet, or you're, especially a female, bleeding out too much iron that you're not keeping up with in your diet. And this is one thing that is checked by basic lab work. Most people know of anemia because they've had a CBC, a complete blood count, and in the CBC there are values of hemoglobin and hematocrit, but there are subtle forms of anemia that can be picked up with ferritin tests. And if somebody's tired and they have a normal value, which is, depending on the lab, somewhere between 12 and 16 in terms of the hemoglobin. But if you have a normal hemoglobin and you're still suspecting you're anemic, a ferritin level can help with that.
Okay. Something else that you'd like to mention?
Well, I was just going to say I'm currently looking for anemic individuals. I think they're a little older than the last caller, but I'm doing a test of a new medical treatment for uterine fibroids, specifically for people who are anemic, with that blood count being under 10. And we're both using a new treatment and also quantifying a method to estimate how much blood loss. So it's a little bit different kind of study. Women are going to be asked to, they're going to be taught a way to estimate how much blood they have lost on their tampons and their Kotex, and we are going to provide those items for them, and we are going to send them to the lab to be processed to actually calculate how accurate their estimates were. And it's kind of an exciting study. So I'm looking for participants. They have to have fibroids and be anemic.
Okay. So do you see much anemia that's the result of inadequate iron intake and diet, or is most anemia, because there's something else going on?
We do, but much less than years ago. What used to be very much more common in vegetarians, because red meat does have good iron quantities, but there's so much good information available about prevention of anemia in your diet, and there are so many good inexpensive supplements if you can't quite do it with diet alone. And I do see much less, but it is often in younger individuals or people who have other reasons that they have gynecologic disorders. They're losing more blood than a reasonable diet can keep up with. So that's where I see it.
Hmm. And certainly if people look at probably all of the over-the-counter multivitamin mineral supplements now, they will have iron in them. Except
many do, but you have to read the label. Some don't.
Well, I guess what I'm thinking about is particularly now, it seems to me that those formulations that are intended for older people, one of the things that they put different stuff in there, but one of the things they drop out is the iron.
Yes.
They don't have the over 50, the senior vitamins, they don't
right.
have iron.
You're not losing as much. Well, obviously, the women stop having menstrual periods, so they just do not lose as much iron. And there's some evidence that if you have too much iron in your diet, that it's actually a negative, that balance, this is one instance where balance is important, and too much and too little are not good.
Anything else real quick?
Well, I was going to talk a little bit more about sleep. I don't know if I have time to go into it all. I know we have a lot of patients that are discontinuing their hormone therapy, or patients first entering their time of menopause and complaining of problems processing their words, problems with their memory, problems keeping as organized, and a huge part of this is sleep deprivation. And there have been a number of new studies coming out. There are going to be some new sleep medications released in the relatively near future. I'm also very interested in this problem, as many of my patients are trying to make these decisions about whether estrogen is useful or not useful. And we're trying now to treat sleep disorders at the time of perimenopause, or the time around menopause, differently than we did before, which previously we pretty much tried to recommend estrogen, and now we're looking for alternatives. So I think that the message is out there, is that, yes, fewer women will be on less estrogen, and they will be on estrogen for shorter periods of time, and many women can safely come off their estrogen, but we do have to remember that women may then experience some side effects that they're going to need treated. But they can be. They just need more individual evaluation and individual targeting of, okay, if we're not going to use estrogen to decrease all the things that it used to decrease our risk for, what else will we be able to do? And I think we're finally coming up with some of those answers, but it's going to take a little bit more research before we have this really well worked out.
All right. Well, I thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.